Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Peter Morris. I'm the National President of the AIPI, and welcome to our first ever AIPI-controlled webinar, which will be on freezing assets. And we want to thank Andrew for kindly making himself available for our debut effort. So thanks to Andrew. So the presentation is scheduled to go for 1 hour. Those of you who are with us, you should be able to see that we have. I'm just checking to see. Getting messages coming through here. Okay, sorry, I was just getting messages there just to make sure we're confirming we're okay. So you should be able to see in your Zoom window there that we will have a group chat window up, and you could use that to send through your questions at any time. So we will be taking questions potentially on the way through, depending on Andrew there, or we'll keep some time at the end of it to answer the questions. So we will be walking through a PowerPoint presentation, and as I say, Andrew will be talking to it. So Andrew, I'll turn the con over to you.
All right, thank you, Peter. So just a little bit about my background, and what I'm going to be talking today about is using the civil courts to recover misappropriated assets for victims of fraud. Perhaps we can put the slide up.
Sure.
So my background is that I'm a barrister at the Victorian Bar now. I travel interstate regularly, acting for clients who are victims of fraud. I'm a former policeman at the Victoria Police. I've done the Fraud Investigators course, and I've been a lawyer for over 20 years now, unfortunately, I'm counting. Solicitor for about 11, and as a barrister for about 11 years, or this is my 12th year as a barrister. And for the most part of my career as a lawyer, whether it be as a solicitor or a barrister, I have been acting for persons either accused of fraud or persons who are victims of fraud, or organisations accused of fraud. Or victims of fraud. So being a solicitor, I've had a good experience of what it's like to take those instructions from persons, and also as a barrister, doing the, you know, appearance work in court and finalising the court documents. So just imagine this, that it's Monday morning at 9 o'clock, and you have a good client of yours who's come, and they're in the reception waiting for you, and they're in a state of shock and distress that they have uncovered a fraud within their organisation, for example. Now, the most common response for that person, I'm just trying to print. Yep. Next slide. Press the next slide. There you go. So the most common response for victims of fraud is to go straight to the police. Now, a lot of solicitors that I know will assist with their clients' concerns and help them to report the matter to the police. And in a naive and ignorant view, that's the best way to secure recovery of misappropriated assets. And the key takeaway of this afternoon from me, with a lot of experience in this area, is that before rushing off to police, it's important to understand what other options the client might have to secure recovery of their misappropriated assets. Of course, when a fraud is first detected, it's all urgent. We've got to rush off, and it's often the case that there might be a suspicion of fraud. It might be that you've got good evidence of fraud, up to a certain amount. But certainly in the early days, my firm advice is to make sure that everyone takes a deep breath, collects their thoughts, and obtains proper advice.
If I can just ask, someone doesn't have their microphone on mute, so if you could just check that, we're getting feedback from someone there on some movement. So if you could please just mute your mics. Thank you. If you just, you should just be able to click, Andrew, just get out of there and click.
Yep. Click on that?
Yeah.
All right, so what are the Victoria Police, for example, advise? And obviously you need to check in each state, but this is what's been taken off the Victoria Police website. So if you Google reporting fraud, you'll find this. This is just a cut and paste from the site, but the police say that they only investigate criminal matters in order to charge offenders and place evidence before a court. Civil action is the most appropriate method of recovering money. One thing is clear is that the police, in my understanding, in all states, want commercial fraud victims to go off and seek recovery themselves. The police do not want to be inundated with private frauds, commercial frauds, whether it be an employee knocking off money from the employer, business partners stealing the money from the business. These are matters that the police have no appetite for, and you're expected to go off and seek your own relief. Of course, the police are interested in certain types of fraud, highly complex matters. This is on their website as well. Matters that involve the misappropriation of public funds, then they've got more of an appetite to get involved. Of course, they're not going to swing into action as quickly as your client would want. So the reason why that slide is up there is because I want to dispel the myth that is out there, and I've been talking about this for many years. The myth out there is that the first thing you do when you be a victim of fraud is you go to the police. My firm advice is not to do that. In Victoria, there's no obligation to report the matter to the police. In some states, there are more restrictions on whether you do or not report. But I can assure you this, no police is going to criticise a client or you as an investigator for rushing off and getting civil recovery before you go down the police route.
Can we okay, move to the next one. Tim, if you wouldn't mind, I won't say any more, you know who you are. If you could just turn your microphone off, please. We're getting feedback from you.
So as far as the key takeaway for today is, my advice is don't go straight to the police. Now, there's some bullet points up there on the screen that you'll see. The bullet point that says different focus is to bring into mind that the police focus is not to recover assets. It's to effectively secure a conviction, okay? At no time in a normal criminal matter will the police feel compelled to seize assets or, you know, follow the money trail. Their job is to secure evidence and bring the offender before the court and secure a conviction. Second bullet point's about the obligation to report. 326 of the Crimes Act is a Victorian provision. There's an offence to effectively not disclose an offence deliberately, not to hide the existence of an offence. But my advice is, if you are seeking civil recovery and you obtain civil recovery and you decide not to go to the police, there is no problem with that. Limited resources, the police themselves, and this is certainly, I don't want this to be in any way criticism of the police, the individual police. within the relevant fraud squads. If I'm not being critical of them, I'm just stating the fact of what it is like in practice. And the fact is that the police have limited resources. The numbers of the fraud squad in Victoria are significantly down on what they used to be, even 10, 15 years ago. They have inadequate training. The detectives at the fraud squad complete the normal detective training school that the Victoria Police do. And there's no real depth of knowledge or training in relation to basic commercial principles. For example, the police do not learn, unless it's changed more recently, but I highly doubt it, the police detectives, the detective training school, do not learn about what a family discretionary trust is. They don't understand the difference between a business name necessarily and a proprietary company. They have never heard of the word fiduciary duty. And because of that inability to understand basic commercial concepts of law, it does prevent them from being able to investigate, in my view, the more sophisticated commercial arrangements, which often fraudsters have, to move money, which might be misappropriated, into places which are harder to get at. No control simply means that once you've reported the matter to the police, you are no longer in control. You are waiting for them to do what they need to do. You are, unlike a plaintiff in a civil case where you are in control and you are the driver, once you report the matter to the police, it's out of your hands. Yes, you can keep ringing the informant and hope that the squeaky wheel gets the oil, but the reality is that you have lost control. In relation to the risk of stay of civil proceedings, my concern is if people do run off to the police and, as I would expect would occur, they report the matter to the police and then it takes years, months, years, whatever, to for the police to swing into action. And the client decides, I can't cope with this delay anymore. I want to issue civil proceedings. I should have followed what Andrew said. Let's issue civil proceedings.
Just again, for those on the line, there's someone there who's got their mic switched on. If you could please mute, we're getting your feedback through to everyone on there. And just a reminder again, check your mics.
So if there's been a report to the police and the client decides they want to issue civil proceedings, there is the ability in circumstances that are defined in law where an accused person who's an accused of criminal conduct can prevent the continuation of the civil proceedings, in other words, have a stay in the civil proceedings until the outcome of the criminal proceedings has been determined. So that's a significant impediment if you go down the police route and change your mind. In other words, you want to have two horses running down the track. Often the civil court will stop the civil case until the outcome of the criminal case. Why? Because of the privilege against self-incrimination. Privilege against self-incrimination overrides the requirement of the defendant in a civil case to put in a defence, for example. The defendant in the criminal case will say, I can't put a defence in the civil case because I'm preserving my right to silence, which is enshrined in law. I'm not going to put a defence in the civil case. I can't put a defence in the civil case because I'm remaining silent in relation to my criminal affairs, which is against the defendant. So the civil court will create what's called a stay, which is certainly something which you'd want to avoid.
Can we click on the next slide?
The next slide, please. Let's just click on there quickly.
Sure. Next slide, please. Let's click again.
Yep.
All right. So the next slide I've headed Blueprint for Action. Obviously, there's no such thing as a blueprint because every case is different. So I want you to use this Blueprint for Action as a starting point for your response if you are acting for a victim of fraud. And in many cases, of course, you as the investigators might be the first ones to get the call. And in many cases, you as investigators, who many of you are former members of police, might automatically assume that the police route is often the best route. It's obvious what I'm going to say is that don't necessarily go down that route. So in the blueprint for action, I've put it into three different categories. And there's a typo there, civil claim should have a three next to it, not a two. In any event, the first part is the investigation stage. Ideally, what you want is to ensure that the investigation is covert. By that, I mean that the suspect of committed the alleged fraudster does not know that they're under investigation. That's the ideal. For me, wanting to go into the Supreme Court to get injunctions later down the track. The best thing is for the person not to know that they're under investigation, not to have been dismissed. You arrange a team of investigators, and this is important because you'll want your IT professionals, you want the people going in, imaging computers, you want to collect and gather the evidence, right? And the team is important. Now, I do not want investigators running off having been contacted by a victim of fraud and doing work without being engaged by a lawyer. And the reason for that is legal professional privilege. You want to make sure that the work that you're doing is covered by legal professional privilege. Now, yes, you might be able to run an argument, well, this is also covered by legal professional privilege because, you know, there was in anticipated litigation. But the reality is, to be on the safe side, the team that you have at the start of your fraud case is a lawyer and it's your investigators. And, of course, the representative of your client that will be involved. And so what you want to do is arrange that team. And I say to the solicitor friends that I've got, don't become amateur investigators. Leave it to the investigators. And that's why I'm delighted that this organisation exists, because unlike the Certified Fraud Examiners Association, who don't tell the world who their investigators are, the Australian Institute of Professional Investigators do have the ability for the public, as I understand, to identify who are the investigators out there that they might be able to get involved. And certainly when I get engaged as a barrister now, I always make sure that when we prepare affidavit material, I always like to have an affidavit of a specialist fraud investigator to support the court action that we want to adopt. So the team should be your IT professional, your investigator, and it might be that the IT professional and investigator are one of the same person, or certainly the same office, a lawyer. And then, of course, you get to the analysis stage. You look at what the evidence is, and it might be that the investigation stage and the analysis stage sort of, there's no clear-cut line as to when starts and when stops, of course. But at some point, someone needs to look at the material, and that's when I certainly like to become involved, look at the evidence that we've got and see what it means. It might be, for example, that there is insurance coverage. Now, insurance coverage is often forgotten in the great excitement of the discovery of fraud. People just forget about insurance. Most businesses have some sort of insurance coverage. Some do not have insurance coverage for all types of fraud. For example, if the fraud's been committed by someone who is one of the officers of the business, for example, a partner, it might be that it's not covered. It might be that they've only got insurance for an employee conducting a fraud on the business. It might be that the insurance has a claim limit. It might be, you know, $100,000 you're covered up to, and then after that, it's you're on your own. So certainly insurance is something that needs to be checked, and, of course, you need to report the matter to the insurance company as part of your contractual obligations with them to ensure that you're indemnified. In some instances, insurance policy will say if you do not notify us of the fraud within a certain amount of time, we will not indemnify you. They want to get involved early. But then again, it's important to understand that the insurance companies, if you've got a good team involved and you're in contact with them and you're telling them what you're doing and your objective is to minimise your loss, mitigate your loss, And most insurance companies would be more than happy for you to keep going. They won't take over the job. Obviously, it requires communication with them. So after the analysis stage, then obviously all roads lead, in my view, to determining whether you've got a civil claim. And in most cases, that's exactly what's going to happen, is you're going to issue proceedings. You're looking at whether you can get injunctions to freeze and freeze misappropriated money or assets of the defendant, and also seize evidence, which I'll get to. No SOC yet means no statement of claim yet. In most cases that I'm involved with fraud, you issue the proceeding in court before you have to detail in chapter and verse what the full extent of your claim is. I mean, I'm involved in a matter at the moment where issued proceedings in the middle of last year, and we still haven't done a statement of claim yet. All the defendant's assets are currently frozen. And the reason why we haven't done a statement of claim yet is because we're still garnering all the material, following the asset trail, and etc. We've taken quite a bit of time getting subpoenas from banks, etc. There's a question here. What is your opinion in relation to reporting to the police if required under the insurance policy? Obviously, if you've got an insurance policy that says you must report to police, you're contractually obliged to do so. And if you do not report the matter to police, then the insurance company may, in their contractual rights, refuse to indemnify. In a situation that happens like that, what I would suggest that you do is engage with the insurance company, okay? The insurance company's main concern is to ensure that they pay out a cheque less than the amount that would otherwise be the case. And if you're engaged with them and you can communicate with them in a certain situation where they know that the purpose of what you are doing is to not report the matter to the police yet, and of course the insurance policy may not be definitive about when you have to report. It might be that you can report after you issue civil proceedings or after you've even got civil recovery. But I would talk to them. I'd engage them. Certainly do not take anything that they say orally. You'd want to get something in writing from them to say that it's no problems for you not to report to the police yet and to exercise your rights civilly. I hope that answers that question. If it doesn't, let me know. So, if you can move to the next slide. My view is that civil, and experience is that civil cases provide you with speed, flexibility and control. The things that the police action do not provide you with. So, what are the standard types of claims that I look at when bringing, and I don't want everyone to go to sleep now, go to the fridge, but I'll just give you a broad overview, because the thing I want to talk about mainly is injunctions, because that's the bit that is quite, I find, investigators are excited about. But I wanted just to go through the common law and some other issues legally. So in common law, which is law made by judges, okay, you've got two types of claims. You can have personal claims or proprietary claims. A personal claim is a claim against specific individuals, all right? And everyone, this is not rocket science, but it's a claim against the actual fraudster, the employee who ripped off $1 million, okay? That bloke in the screen there putting the money in his jacket pocket, that's the guy who is the defendant in your claim against the individual. Now, personal claims are in two categories. There's the claims where you do not have to prove knowledge or dishonesty, okay? And they are unjust enrichment or money hadn't received claims and conversion. Those cases are extremely, or those courses of action are extremely helpful to lawyers because, of course, proving fraud, even if it's at the civil standard, is not easy. Whereas if you can show that a person has received your money or your client's money and there's been no consideration for them receiving the money, they've just got it and there's been no agreement in relation to the matter, you don't have to say, oh, they are dishonest. You just say, they have got our money, we want it back, okay? That's the case. You don't have to prove fraud, okay? The second category of cases is the knowledge cases, which do require elements of dishonesty to be proven at the civil standard, which is called the Brigginshaw standard when proving fraud cases. So just to be clear, in the civil standard of proof, what you need to do is you have to prove case on the balance of probabilities. That's a normal civil case. But if you are alleging fraud, the courts say, well, you've got to do a bit better than the balance of probabilities. You've got to prove it to the reasonable satisfaction of the court. It's a slightly higher standard. There are no clear-cut lines here, but certainly if you are wanting to prove fraud, it's a harder hurdle to jump over than just the normal civil case, which you can use in those knowledge cases. And I can say that 99% of the cases that I run, I don't allege knowledge because you don't need to. And what is the relief? Well, obviously, you get the normal damages, equitable compensation, which is a more generous analysis by the courts in relation to what compensation might put the victim of fraud back into the position they were before the fraud was committed upon them. And you've also got personal liability to account. In some cases, that could include where a person has invested money and you get the fruits of that investment. There's a lot of law on this, and it's not always going to be that case, but certainly the very flexible remedies that you can potentially seek. I'll just change the slide. So moving from the personal claims to the proprietary claims. Proprietary claims are claims over a particular asset exercisable against the whole world. So you're broadening the net of potential defendants. And here we're talking about the world of constructive trusts, and they're imposed in two broad situations. One is a breach of a pre-existing fiduciary duty. Now, a fiduciary duty is established when there is a relationship of trust between two parties. What are the most common examples of fiduciary relationships? They are lawyer and client, accountant and client, solicitor, that's lawyer and client, but a business partner to business partner, joint venturer to joint venturer, employee to employer. If there is a breach of that duty, then strict liability is imposed, no obligation to prove dishonesty. And a trust is imposed over assets held by that person which have been misappropriated assets of the plaintiff. The second area where constructive trusts are imposed is where there's been unconscionable conduct of the defendant, where there's no fiduciary relationship but where they receive stolen property and have some knowledge, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Now, the important thing about those proprietary claims, of course, is that the property is held on trust by the bankrupt. So let's just say you're the victim of a fraud and you've got a proprietary claim. Let's say your money has gone into the home loan. Your claim is over you have a charge over that asset being the home. And just because the person's gone bankrupt doesn't mean that, oh, it's all over. Your claim survives the bankruptcy. So it's a very powerful tool, having a proprietary claim as opposed to a personal claim. So let's move on. Now, a knowing or unconscionable receipt claim is really the stuff that you use when you've got a fraudster who puts all the money in the wife's bank account or puts the money into a mortgage which is solely in the name of the wife. That's the typical sort of area where it comes up. And it's a very powerful weapon because it extends the claim against all recipients of the stolen proceeds. So it's a fantastic area of law because the fraudster can be caught thinking, oh, it's not in my name, you can't get me. Well, yes, we can. We can if we've established the defendant, as in the wife, has a certain level of knowledge, and it can only be a sufficient level of knowledge. And you see the bullet point there, the sufficient level of knowledge to have the wife on the hook is knowledge of the circumstances that would indicate the facts to an honest and reasonable person. It's more than knowledge of the circumstances that would put an honest and reasonable person on inquiry, okay? So it's, you know, you need good evidence. And this is why I rely so heavily on good fraud investigators, because you're going to get that evidence by good investigation. Good investigation is the prerequisite for all these claims, because unless you can establish evidence to show that this person knew the facts, right? Not this person, but a reasonable person in their position knew the facts because of all these things that we've lined up, then the claim survives. And that's why we rely so heavily on good investigators. So we'll move to the next slide. So moving from the common law claims or equitable claims, judge-made claims or causes of action, we've got statutory claims as well, which we can't forget. Now, the telephone book piece of legislation called the Corporations Act has substantial causes of action that we can bring in relation to claims against fraudsters. And I've just given a snapshot of just two broad areas. One is the breach of duties and powers of officers. An officer of a corporation is broadly defined and can cover a wide range of employees who may not necessarily and do not have to be directors. And the obligations under the Corporations Act to act in good faith and the best interests of the corporation under Section 81 can often be added on to your normal common law claim. So in many cases, I'll have a statement of claim where I'll allege common law causes of action, and I'll also throw in statutory causes of action as well. Voidable transactions, of course, many of you would be familiar with. They're the transactions which can be clawed back where a corporation or a person becomes insolvent and they try to dissipate assets before the hammer falls in an attempt to defeat creditors. And you've got a broad spectrum of provisions within the Corporations Act for that as well, and the Bankruptcy Act. Tracing is another ripe source of law for the fraud litigator. And I hope everyone's still awake. But tracing is a means by which the claimant, the victim of fraud, can link the fraud with certain assets believed to be the proceeds of that fraud. Now, there's two parts of tracing. One is common law tracing and one is equitable tracing. Equitable tracing is the one that I use the most because that can be done where the subject matter, the stolen money, for example, is mixed with other property. People say, oh, you can't do tracing because it's mixed into the bank account of all this other legitimate money. It's not necessarily the case. That's common law tracing. Equitable tracing is far more generous in its ability to follow misappropriated money into the hands of third parties and other accounts that might be held by a fraudster. So it's not a cause of action, it's a process by way you seek recovery of your money or your assets. So that's the snapshot of the causes of action. Now let's talk about injunctions. So where I have victims of fraud come to me and they have there's sufficient evidence to establish a cause of action, but the first thing I want to do is get a freezing order. And a freezing order is what I say, it allows the plaintiff to get a foot over the assets of the fraudster. Thank you, Ben Parker. I'm glad you're still awake and that I'm doing well. So freezing orders. There's Lord Denning, who's a judge that was in England, called freezing orders and search orders, which I'll talk about next, to be the law's two nuclear weapons. And the reason why they say that is because they're so powerful, obviously. They're a very effective tool that the commercial fraud litigator uses, and I use all the time. I'm happy to say that I've never applied for a freezing order and not got one. But the reason why I've always got one is because I've got the good evidence in support of it. Now, so what is a freezing order? A freezing order is an order made by a court in circumstances where the court is satisfied that in the circumstances presented before it, there is enough evidence to show that the defendant to the court case may act in a way so as to frustrate the due administration of justice. So in simple terms, if you're in a situation where you've got a case against a fraudster and that person, and the case is that this person is dishonest, then that founds the reasonable apprehension that you, the plaintiff, are concerned that unless the court grants a freezing order, by the time this case is ultimately determined, in a year's time or whenever that might be, without the freezing order, the person might remove their assets to another jurisdiction or get rid of them, hand them over to the wife in an attempt to frustrate the process of the court. All the freezing order does is preserve the status quo. It means that they cannot deal with their assets up to a certain amount, which is usually the amount of your claim, until judgment. Now, it might be that, and in most circumstances that I'm aware of, in the cases that I run, once you get the freezing order, the case is over. Because what do you need to get a freezing order? You need to establish that you've got what's called a strong arguable case, or a good arguable case, or a prima facie case, as sometimes they call it. If you can establish by good evidence that you've got a strong claim against this individual and the court's prepared to grant a freezing order, it's very unlikely that the person's lawyers, unless they can come up with some magic rabbit out of the hat, that there's something completely wrong here. There's no point running a case to a trial. The case will resolve, and that's usually what happens when I issue these or get these freezing orders from the court. So it prevents the frustration of the court's process. It preserves the status quo. And the other thing that can happen when you apply for these freezing orders, and it's important for you to know that when I go into court to get a freezing order, the defendant does not know you're there. They're done ex parte. All right. So before, when I talked about the blueprint for action and we talked about having a covert investigation, the reason why I like the covert investigation is because I don't want them to know we're coming. The first thing I want the defendant to know is when the person gets a knock at the door with a process server saying, here you go, Peter Morris, you've got a freezing order here, you've got a writ and a claim against you, you've got to come to court next week in response to this. And so what happens with the freezing order? You apply for the freezing order, you need affidavit material and support, setting out in chapter and verse what the claim is. And that usually would be an affidavit by the victim of the fraud or the solicitor for the victim of the fraud. And the investigator. And the investigator's affidavit is normally the one that has all the meat in it to show I was engaged on X date. The suspicion was the following. I have investigated the matter and this is the result of my investigation. Mm-hmm. Okay. There's a question, what is the risk of a debt in your claim if you freeze business assets? I don't know. I'm not sure if I understand the question. The price, and maybe this might answer the question, I'm not sure, but the price for getting a freezing order is that you must give what's called the undertaking as to damages. Now, the undertaking of damages is a promise that you make to the court, which can be relied upon by the defendant, to say, I will compensate, as in the plaintiff, the plaintiff will compensate and have the means to compensate persons who are the subject of this freezing order who may be adversely affected by it. If the freezing order is, for example, over a business and the business has contracts that it must fulfil, let's just say it's got to pay $500,000 in relation to a pre-existing contract, that was placed genuinely and in good faith before the operation of the freezing order came into play. The freezing order will not prevent that contract from occurring. The freezing order will not prevent the defendant from accessing their funds to pay for reasonable legal expenses, which are usually capped by the plaintiff in their application. The starting point, I say, in the freezing order application is that the defendant can have up to $10,000 of their money spent on lawyers. And if they want more than that, then they have to seek a variation of the freezing order. The freezing order does not prevent people from paying the school fees. Doesn't prevent the ordinary transactions in the usual course of business. Okay, it's not there to try and suffocate a defendant and assert rights beyond preserving the status quo. So people often say, oh, you know, they shouldn't be able to continue to pay the private school fees. Well, yes, they can, because the payment of the private school fees is not an intention to dissipate assets to avoid a judgment. The freezing order is there to try and to avoid transferring money from a bank account to Liechtenstein or something like that, not to have the usual expenses. In order to get a freezing order, the question is from McGrath-Nicol, in order to get a freezing order in a fraud case, wouldn't you need to go to trace the stolen proceeds into that asset? The answer is no, definitely not. You do not need a freezing order. You don't need to trace into a particular asset to get a freezing order at all. Just before I talk about search orders, in the freezing order process, you can also obtain ancillary orders, and the two most common ancillary orders are one, and this is the one with the most utility, I find, is the asset disclosure order. The asset disclosure order is an order in addition to the freezing order which compels the respondent to the freezing order to provide an affidavit of assets disclosing what their assets are within a certain amount of time, usually 7 days. And that means that the person who's served with the freezing order has to swear an affidavit saying, this is what I've got, and it includes assets not only in their name personally, but also assets which they may have an indirect interest in. For example, property held in someone else's name, which might be held in trust for that person. Those asset disclosure affidavits are, of course, vital for a plaintiff because you want to know what they've got, because you want to know whether the case is worth pursuing and where assets have been purchased recently. That might give you a source of inquiry for pursuing tracing claims. The other ancillary order is an order which requires respondents to deliver up their passports to prevent them from leaving the country. Search orders are the second nuclear weapon that Lord Denning described, and they again are to prevent the frustration of the court's process. They're done again in a situation where the defendant does not know you've gone to the court to apply for the order until they receive the order. And the order is to preserve the status quo. It's to preserve evidence as opposed to preserving assets like the freezing order. The preserving of the evidence is required because, again, you say to the court, Your Honour, the moment this defendant becomes aware that we've got a proceeding against them is the moment that they will start destroying evidence. And so we want a search order. We want to be able to enter into the person's business premises or residence or whatever the case may be, could be their accountant's office, to seize evidence. Again, you need substantial affidavit material, and I can tell you that the courts are they're more reluctant to grant a search order than they are a freezing order, because, of course, with a search order, you're going into someone's home, which is a very draconian measure, but it's one that's sometimes necessary. Some of you may have been involved in these sorts of orders before, in the execution, that is, because the execution of a search order is quite a complicated thing. you need what's called a search party. And in that search party, you need, as in the plaintiff needs, to have an independent supervising solicitor. That's not the plaintiff's solicitor. That's a solicitor from a firm separate from the plaintiff's law firm, who their job is to firstly be paid by the plaintiff for executing the search order. And that means that person knocks on the door and says, hello, my name's Andrew Tregard. I'm from ABC Proprietary Limited. I've been engaged as an independent supervising solicitor by the Supreme Court to execute these documents on you, to serve these documents on you. May I come inside? I need to explain them to you. That's the job of the independent supervising solicitor. And you need a good independent supervising solicitor. You don't want to have a shrinking violet that gets the doors shut on their face. The execution of the search order is required by the order, and to refuse to allow entry would be contempt. But you do want to make sure that your supervising solicitor is someone that is a robust individual, but at all times independent. The second independent person is the independent computer expert. When I first started getting these search orders, you didn't need an independent computer expert. The computer expert would just have to be someone that the plaintiff had engaged. Now the person has to be an independent person, not the plaintiff's computer expert, but an independent expert. So if you've got, for example, McGrath-Nichol doing the expert evidence in relation to what happened to the proceeds of the fraud, it's more than likely that you would not use McGrath-Nichol's computer images to be the independent computer expert in the execution of the search order. You'd have to use a different firm for the purposes of that. And the plaintiff solicitor and a representative of the plaintiff. So if you're doing a search, of premises, and often these in more substantial fraud cases, you might have three premises being searched at one time. So you've got three different search parties. And you are obviously, it's a bit like the police does where you're doing a simultaneous raid. It's very exciting. You do it pre-dawn and you have to do it in the circumstances where the first residence doesn't ring the second residence to say, hey, they're coming, and start shredding the documents. So it has to be done well. Often the search of premises can take many, many hours, sometimes well into the night. So be prepared. Take your packed lunch. You don't want to be leaving the house halfway through the day to go and get your KFC. You want to have your sandwich there and keep going. You need to have a document registry, because what you want to do is be able to identify what are the things that are being taken. Now, what can you take? Well, the court's already determined what you can take, because in your search order, it'll list the things that are items that are relevant for the purposes of the search. So, and this is again what's so important for me, you need to have investigators to assist the lawyers to work out, okay, so if we do go in, what are we looking for? Why do we want these things? How can we identify these things with some sort of precision so that when we do get in there, there's no dispute? What do you do if there is a dispute as to whether an item is a listed thing that you are entitled to take, or something which might be protected by legal professional privilege or solicitor client privilege, or something that the person at the other end says, that's not relevant to the search order, you can't take that. What do you do? Well, I'll tell you what you do. You ensure that the independent supervising solicitor supervises the process and puts every item of evidence which is in dispute in a box, which then be sealed for the purposes of just debate later down the track. The importance, as I stress, is to preserve the status quo. You do not want to have documents that might be relevant left at the premises because you may never see them again. So the execution of a search order is particularly, it's costly. You certainly wouldn't want to be doing search orders for claims under $50,000, in my view, because, if you've got six people or five or six people executing a search order, that's costly in itself. So we're talking about the big ticket type of frauds, in my view, when you're going down the search order route. Different thing for the freezing orders, though. The cost of the freezing order is the cost of garnering the material in support of the freezing order and applying for it in court. With search orders, you've got the additional cost of the execution of the order. So that's why it can become quite expensive. But again, if you get a freezing order and or a search order, in my experience, in most cases, it's all over. They come to the party, they want to resolve the matter, and you get a deal done very quickly.
Interesting, Andrew, just one quick question. We're getting a range of questions coming through now, which is really good. But one of them interesting there, does the search order allow for an investigator to be present during the execution?
The search order will identify the persons permitted to conduct the search. So if you're an investigator engaged, by all means, you should, if your name's on the order, and when I go into court seeking a search order, I list the people who I want to enter. I list the items that I want to be seized. So certainly there's nothing to prevent the investigator to be present during the execution at all if they're identified.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm sure we've got a lot of other questions. We'll try and get to those towards the back end there.
So the harm and obligation is something that people don't know, in my experience, and that is easily just read off the slide. Documents and information produced under compulsion in contentious legal proceedings, which are not in the public domain, are not to be used for a collateral purpose to the proceeding in which the document was originally produced, unless leave of the court is first obtained. What does that mean? It means if you get a search order or you obtain documents from the other side in discovery, you're not allowed to race off and give them to the coppers, because that would be in breach of the harm and obligation. What you would have to do if you want to hand over material to the police after you've obtained your successful resolution of your civil case is you want to get an order of the court granting you leave to produce documents to the police, okay? So just be careful not to provide anything, and it could be not to the police if you want to provide it. It could be to the insurance company. It could be to issue proceedings against someone else, okay? So just be aware, if you get documents in one proceeding, they're not to be used for a collateral purpose unless you get the permission of the court. There's a question from Timothy. Often small business clients are reluctant to pursue civil action because of the potential cost and therefore tend to prefer police action or do nothing at all. Any comments? Well, I'd agree that that's what often is the case, absolutely. You wouldn't want to issue civil proceedings if the fraud wasn't, you know, if it was less than $50,000, you know, often people might just say, look, we'll just write it off, absolutely. And yes, they might want to go down the police route to avoid the cost of civil proceedings. It depends upon how much is involved, but certainly Tim's observation of what small business clients are likely to do is an observation which I'm familiar with. And obviously, look, if there's no money worth chasing, then why would you issue civil proceedings? My concern, of course, always is if you've got a substantial amount of money that has been misappropriated, then civil action gives you the speed, the flexibility and control to have a chance of getting your money back. It depends upon how much is involved, of course. Mm-hmm.
And Andrew, just an interesting question in there around imaging a phone. Can you compel them to hand over the PIN for the phone? Obviously, we've had instances in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I mean, it's the same thing. It's like the cloud and all these devices which require passwords. It's the same thing as having documents in a security share. Okay. You've got to frame the order well so it does specify precisely what the obligations are of the respondents. But I've had cases where, there's been a car parked in the driveway, and the person says, "Well, you haven't got any permission to search my vehicle, I don't know where the keys are." And you can see there's a laptop in the back seat, that's why you want to make sure that the order that you're seeking. I mean, the court's not going to draft the order for you. You, the plaintiff's lawyer, the barrister, has to draft the order in a way which is going to give the client the best protection and the best means of securing everything you want. So things like passwords and phones, you do want to have your auditor to spell that out, absolutely.
Okay. All right, just bearing in mind.
And just if I can just stop you there, if, for example, you had a dispute in relation to whether the auditor did require the person to do it, a good independent supervising solicitor would put the phone in the box of the disputed items and you can argue about it later.
Right. Right? Okay. Excellent. All right. But...
All right. So I was going to talk about a couple of war cases, or war stories, I should say, just to finish off, to highlight the effective use of civil proceedings as a first course of action before you go down the police route. So the Dinner Confaders case was a good example of that. This was a case where the company was doing extremely well. It was run by a sole director who the last thing he wanted to do was spend all day in the office writing checks and doing internet banking. And so he engaged someone to do that work for him, and surprise, surprise, that individual put company funds into his own account, wrote checks out to companies which he'd set up, which sounded like suppliers that weren't suppliers, and it was several hundred, or it was actually over $1 million, I think, that we had to deal with. Anyway, Russell Tate was the managing director's name, and he came to me with one of our members of the AIPI, Shane Ringan, and Russell just wanted to go to the police. And he was in tears. He was very upset. I just want to go to the police, thinking that that is where you go when you've been a victim of fraud. I told Russell what I've told everyone in the last hour. Let's go down the civil route. Within a few days, we were in the Supreme Court. We got a freezing order over the assets of the defendant. Those assets were which were owned jointly by the defendant and his wife. We did not have a claim against the wife. Mm-hmm. But the assets that we were able to obtain, so we got the freezing order. Very quickly after that, the solicitor for the defendant came to us and said, we want to just give back as what we can, you know, we're very sorry, you know, full remorse, etc. Don't go to the police. And we entered into terms of settlement, and we basically took the ride on mower, the diamond rings off the wife's fingers, the whole lot, because they were desperate to provide Dinell Confaders with the maximum compensation they could, because they were worried that Russell would report the matter to the police. And of course, they were worried that, you know, no one wants to go to jail. Of course, there's no requirement for a civil litigant to promise not to go to the police. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. And we didn't. Certainly, it was in their interest to provide full compensation or as much as they could, because if we did go to the police, which was our option, that would minimise ultimately, you would think, any the time that they might spend in prison, or potentially allow them to avoid prison.
Mm-hmm.
So that was done. We got the civil recovery. Russell then went to the New South Wales Police, where the defendant lived. And Shane and I had to go up and spend quite a lot of time with the detective, because he didn't know anything about fraud, didn't really want to do the work, but we just went up and just helped him prepare the brief. And ultimately there was a criminal prosecution, plea of guilty, and the gentleman went to jail. There's a question, wasn't that case in New South Wales, and would you not have an obligation to report? Yeah, absolutely. And we did.
Mm-hmm. That question's a bit delayed. All right, so we're coming up to the last minute there. Andrew, we've got time probably for one more case study there, and then if you keep your questions coming through.
Well, now, Rail Plus, if you Google Ostley, which is the legal case, it's got a list of all the cases, you just type in that... you'll read that case. It's on the internet. It's the judgment's on the internet. It was a case where we were able to. Well, I was going to talk about another case, but I may as well talk about this case quickly, because it was an interesting case. Good claim against the director, who was a crook. He ripped a client off for $2 million plus. He said, I've got no assets, he agreed that we could enter judgment against him for the full amount of the claim, which is over $2 million. He said, but there's no point having a judgment because I've got no money.
Right.
He lived with his wife, he said, oh, it's not my wife, she's my ex-wife. We're separated under one roof. All the assets are hers. When we said to the court, well, look, we've got a judgment against this guy for over $2 million. We're going to bankrupt him, and the trustee in bankruptcy we're going to fund because we want to recover the money held by the ex-wife because we think it's a sham divorce. Mm-hmm. We think that the monies that this is are not his are truly his. So, in effect, what we're saying is we've got a judgment for $2 million plus. The matrimonial assets are X. He, if he was not a crook, would be admitting, listen, I've got an interest in those assets, and therefore that interest should go to the creditors in the bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
And the court and the wife sought a discharge of the freezing order in the Supreme Court, saying they've got no right to freeze my assets. It's got nothing to do with me. I knew nothing about this. We're divorced.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court preserved the freezing order on the basis that we did have an equitable claim that we did want to bring on behalf of him in relation to the assets that she held,
right,
because it was a sham divorce. So it's an interesting case which is well worth reading.
Oh, yeah. All right, so we've come pretty much to the end, conscious of everyone's time there. We don't have any new questions on there, but if anyone's got any questions in final left, Andrew, speed type them through. And just whilst we're waiting for those, Andrew, this has been fascinating. I think my phone's been ringing with text messages of applause all the way through
various
members. So thanks for the feedback from everyone going through there. I think it's been terrific. And on behalf of the AIPI, not just here in Victoria, but nationally, and we have had people who have registered from around the country everywhere to this one in. So it's fantastic to have that on board. And we hope to keep the quality of this sort of webinar coming through to the members over the course of this year. We're just getting, again, good feedback through from there. So in light of that, we will hold off. There's Andrew's details up there. And as you can well tell from the content today, he is the leading expert in this area. So, again, thank you, Andrew.
My pleasure.
And thanks for everyone for dialing in and signing off from the AIPI.